from KQED.
Hey, everybody. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. And today on The Breakdown, less than a week into her high-profile appointment by Mayor London Breed, San Francisco's new district attorney, Brooke Jenkins, joins us to talk about her plans to make residents feel more safe.
Jenkins was a prosecutor in the homicide unit when she quit last year and helped lead the successful recall of District Attorney Chesa Boudin. On day one, she said she wanted to review all pending plea deals in drug cases, definitely a sign that she's setting a new direction for the office, and she's here to tell us more about that and much more. Brooke Jenkins, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thank you. I really am happy to be here.
I know you've been on a sprint this first week, so we appreciate your being here. We do want to talk about, obviously, your plans for the office, but we always like to get to know our guests a little bit first. Tell us about your family. I know your dad was from El Salvador and had to go back there when he was young. He had a student visa issue. Tell us about, him and your mom and growing up here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, so I grew up across the bay over in Union City, Fremont area. My parents met when they were in college here in the East, in the Bay Area as well. And my dad, who was here on student visa from El Salvador, ended up leaving shortly after he finished school here in the United States. And so I was raised by a single mother my entire life with the support, of course, of my extended family, my grandmother especially. And spent my whole childhood in the Bay Area and ended up going to UC Berkeley, where I ran track, which most people always wonder what event. And I ran the 400-meter hurdles.
Oh, nice. So did you keep in touch with your dad growing up?
I did not. I actually met my dad when I was 21 years old.
Oh, wow. Mm.
What was that like?
Yeah.
It's something that I had always I'd always wondered who he was and what his life was like and whether I had siblings my whole life. So it was a big deal to meet him, and we are now actually very close. It took some time to develop that relationship, but he's now involved with his grandkids when he can see them, when he can travel here.
Oh, that's great. So you grew up in Union City. Mm-hmm. Your mom, I believe, is Black.
Yes.
And you've talked in the past about having family members who experience police brutality or discrimination. Can you talk about that and just generally what your sort of perception of law enforcement was like growing up?
Yeah. So I grew up listening to my grandmother talk about one of her older brothers. She was one of 11 children born in East Texas, and at a time when, of course, the South was segregated. And she only had two brothers that I never got to meet, one of whom she always talked about having died in police custody, and how the police had given one excuse for his death, but that the family always believed that he had been killed while he was in their custody. And so, I grew up, like most young Black kids, questioning law enforcement and not trusting them, not liking the police, and watching other family members be, what we considered, racially profiled. Oh, you fit the description. So now we get to stop and search you. So it was not, law enforcement was never something that I saw myself going into, certainly.
And when you were growing up, did you watch true crime shows or, Law and Order, how did you get from, what you just described, which is a attitude about the police, to actually, eventually, it wasn't right away, but eventually
right.
going
you're,
in that direction?
You're skipping ahead, Scott.
I'm still watching TV.
When I was a kid, I remember loving two shows that came on Thursday night. One was Ben Matlock. It came on Thursday at 8 and In the Heat of the Night, which came on Thursday at 9. And so, that's what sparked my interest watching Matlock and wanting to be a lawyer. But I never really associated that with any type of law. Mm-hmm. Not really having close contact with any lawyers. I just never, sort of thought about being a criminal lawyer or anything else. I just knew I wanted to be in a courtroom arguing with people.
Well, we mentioned you went to Cal, you majored in poli sci and African American studies, you ran track, and then you ended up going to law school. What drove that decision and what kind of law? I mean, I know you ended up in corporate law, but was that the intention?
No, it was not the intention. But when you're, raised by a single mother who you've watched struggle most of your life, who's had to work two jobs at times, sometimes the the money attracts you to certain things. And when you go to a top 10 law school, it makes it very easy to walk in the door of a corporate law firm. And so I think that's what sort of channeled me in that direction, especially because I didn't have a certain type of law that I was committed to practicing. And, you know, I learned a lot while I was in corporate law. You learn how to be a very efficient and good lawyer. You have to be perfect because that's what your corporate clients require of you. And so it was a great training ground ultimately, but just not where my passion lied at that time.
Did that create a conflict at all for you? I think you did some work on behalf of corporations, maybe a pharmaceutical industry and Toyota in liability issues. I mean, that's a far cry from what you're doing now. I mean, did you feel, you know, have any mixed feelings?
Yeah,
conflicted about
it. Oh, yeah. It's tough. You know, when you're in products liability work, you have individual plaintiffs, and so who have suffered some type of loss or injury. And so there are times when it's very, very difficult to, you know, stay focused on your client's interest, even sometimes when you question, you know, the circumstance of the case. But at the end of the day, I did feel like our clients always wanted to be fair in the way that the case is played out.
As long as you won.
Or settled.
There's a lot of settlement yeah, that goes on.
It's all law, really.
Know when to fold them.
So, Brooke, you're a mom now, but I'm curious. Tell us about your husband. When did you guys meet? How did you guys meet?
We met in the third grade.
Oh, wow. We skipped ahead past that.
So we met in the third grade. We went to elementary school together. And I ended up branching off and going to school elsewhere after sixth grade. And we kept in contact a little bit after that because I knew where he went to high school. But we hadn't seen each other since, I think, senior year of high school until we reunited at almost 30 years old, and would have never predicted that we would have ended up married when we were kids. But here we are.
Wow. That's sweet.
You talked very openly and very movingly at both your swearing in and your announcement about your firstborn child, who was named Justice, who died very young of, you said, natural causes. How did you process that as a young mom?
It was very difficult, to be honest. It's not something you can ever prepare yourself for. You think as a woman, once you get past sort of the first trimester or that first 12 weeks, that, you know, it's smooth sailing and your baby's just going to arrive here and you're going to be wheeled out of the hospital holding that child. And so to have to leave the hospital without him was the hardest thing I've ever done. And to be honest, at times, you know, I didn't know. I didn't know what my next steps were. I didn't know what my purpose was going to be. And it took some time to recover and get to a place where I could really pursue what that purpose was going to be.
And you have a daughter now, right?
Yes. And so now I have a 6-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So you're in it.
Yes. My hands are full completely right now.
How has this new job sort of changed their lives and, you know, your mom's, who is probably doing more childcare?
Yeah, so it's a big difference. My son in particular, because of the pandemic, had been very accustomed to having me at home more. Mm-hmm. And so now he repeatedly is saying, "Mommy goes to work," which is new for him to have me out of the house all day. My daughter, the biggest adjustment for her, I think, is the security detail that I have. And so the other morning she says, "But Mommy, I don't want to ride with your security." And so I had to tell her, well, you know what? It's probably a good thing, because that means I get to sit in the back and just talk to you,
right?
all the way to camp. My mom has really, really stepped in, and, you know, she's a full-time grandma. And so I wouldn't survive without her support.
All right. Before we take a break, we want to talk about how you came to this office, which is that you did join the DA's office in 2014, starting as most DAs do, prosecuting misdemeanors. What drew you at that point in your life after losing your son to apply for that job?
Yeah, I had met two black prosecutors in another county, in Santa Clara County, where I was working at the time, at the time I got pregnant with Justice. And they talked so excitedly about the work that they were doing. And that was really what piqued my interest in it, to say, wow, you know, they sound like they love what they're doing and it sounds interesting. And, you know, maybe that would be something I would like, but I never pursued it at that time. And so ultimately you know, when I was trying to figure out my next step and what my purpose was, I said, you know, that's something that would allow you to connect with people, to be a voice for people who need one, right? Who are suffering some kind of pain, because at that time I was still really struggling with my grief. And I tried out the public defender's office first, actually.
In San Francisco?
In San Francisco. And I'll tell you the truth. It was a murder case. And the father of the murder victim was sitting in the courtroom the whole entire trial. And I remember just looking at him and saying to myself, I just buried my son too. And I know that pain. And I just need to be a voice for people like you. And so that's ultimately what led me to pursue working at the DA's office.
Wow. All right, we're going to talk much more about that, but we're going to take a short break right now. And when we return, we'll continue our conversation with San Francisco's new district attorney, Brooke Jenkins. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. We're happy to have with us today San Francisco's district attorney, Brooke Jenkins, named to the job last week by Mayor London Breed after voters recalled DA Chesa Boudin. And before the break, we were talking about what drew you into working in the DA's office. And you quit last year. You were a prosecutor in the homicide unit, and then you helped lead this recall of Boudin. Is it fair to say that as it became clear that he was going to lose, maybe post June 7th, that you lobbied for the job? Did you want it?
No, I wouldn't say that's fair at the time that the recall was going on.
What about after? Like when it was obvious?
After it passed, I did express interest in the job, in part because I wanted to make sure that whoever took over was somebody who was truly passionate and dedicated to this work, didn't see it as a stepping stone to something else political, had, experience doing the work. And so that meant a lot to me.
What was the interview process like? I mean, my understanding is that the mayor made pretty specific demands of all the folks you talked to about what she wanted to see done. Did you make promises to the mayor? And how did you present yourself?
It was a very intense process, I will say that, and I think I had 3 interviews with her. I would not say she made demands of me during that interview, but she did have a laundry list of questions about, certain topics, certain issues. I assume based on conversations she had had with members of the public and what was significant to them. And so she wanted to make sure that whoever took over, it appeared to me, had a concrete understanding of the office and of what it was going to take to help get this city turned around.
So you now are in charge of an office that you were criticizing during the campaign in terms of its management. How do you rebuild trust? There was some reporting on the first meeting that you had with staff right after you were sworn in. Sounds from those reports that it didn't go as well as maybe you'd hoped it would. Icy, I think, difficult conversations. But how do you fix things?
I think we have to become one. Even before this recall, during my time in the office, things were very divided. It was there was a divide between who had been hired by previous administrations and who had been hired by CHESA. And that's something that I don't want to exist going forward. And that's really what I expressed in that meeting was simply, look, we all have one mission here, and it's to provide, you know, services to this community, which is legal services that are to ensure their safety, right? And to make sure that we are treating those who enter into this system fairly. And, you know, what I wanted was to see that divide go away. And, you know, not everybody's going to be willing to do that. And that's just the case, right? We're seeing that play out. But overall, that's what I want my staff to do, is to let that guard down, to all become unified in our mission, because that's what the public deserves.
I'm curious, though. I mean, Scott Sutter mentioned morale, and I think that this is an office that struggled with that predating CHESA Boudin. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, you've talked about people needing to be patient, that one prosecutor, one DA isn't going to change crime trends overnight. And yet the construct of the recall was very much putting the problems of the city on one person's back. How much time, why should voters give you a different sort of opportunity to prove yourself? And how much time do you think we should give?
I think what I was saying was that I can't snap my fingers and make crime disappear, right? And I made that clear every time that I talked about the recall, that I didn't think everything was Chase's fault. I never could have put that.
Maybe a lot of the people who supported the recall did, though.
Okay. Well, I can't speak for them, but I can only speak for what I said. And I always attempted to be fair to him, that no, he can't control natural trends in crime. But what we do serve as when we sit in this district attorney's position is someone who's supposed to serve as a deterrent to crime, and to do our best to curtail it, and to hold those who choose to commit crime accountable. And that's where I believed his policies were failing, and his management was failing.
So one of the very first things you did was to, when you met with your staff, to say that you wanted to review all the plea deals in drug cases that had not yet been accepted. And I think there was some ambiguity there. Like, are we talking, when you're saying you're going to crack down on you know, open air drug dealing, does that include possession? I mean, is this a change in tone, or is it a change in policy? I mean, how do you strike that balance?
Yeah, and so I want to make clear that what I asked for was open drug dealing cases where an offer had been extended and not accepted. So I was not asking for cases that involve simple possession of drugs, because we have a job to do. And I needed to see, and I still need to see, what exactly is the lay of the land as far as offers that were being made in these cases, and are they appropriate? Do they promote accountability? And that was simply the first category of case that I asked them to prioritize. I also need to do that in serious and violent offender cases, right? To make sure that we are giving offers that are appropriate for that particular, each particular case. And what I know is that the data in 2021 suggested that things that were, the way that these cases were being settled, the drug cases, was not promoting accountability. And so that's something that I wanted to see for myself. Again, accountability is going to look like many different things depending on each individual offender's profile and the facts of their case. But we can no longer be minimizing the sale of particularly fentanyl as though it's a victimless crime.
So how do you do that? I mean, this is not, you know, we saw the mayor roll out her 90-day campaign in the Tenderloin. If you walk through there, it looks no different, honestly, than it did a few months ago. A lot of reporting, you know, noted that there were people doing drugs across from your press conference as police officers walked by. The war on drugs is considered a failure. What is your approach? What will you do differently? Because so much has been tried and failed, and so much of this is about policing, not necessarily just prosecuting.
Yeah. And I walked by people using drugs openly on the street when I was there the other morning. For me, I think it's twofold. We've got to be getting people who are struggling with substance addiction into treatment. Sometimes that means, right, if they get caught burglarizing somewhere or committing another crime, that we use that as the opportunity to give them the connection to recovery and require that they engage in treatment. For those that are selling, I think, yeah, conditions from what I've heard from Tenderloin residents is that they have gotten worse over the last couple of years. And I would attribute that to a lack of consequences for drug dealing. Of course, nobody's going to stop doing it, and more people will pour into San Francisco to do it if they don't think anybody's going to do anything about it. And so
that starts with the police. though, correct? I mean, it in terms of arrests. I mean, if there, if, and there was a lot of anecdotal evidence and some things caught on video that showed the police not really pursuing crimes in some cases that were underway.
Shoplifting. You know? And I mean, we know from years of criminology research that policing actually, you know, somebody thinking they're going to get caught in the moment has way more to do with, you know, than whether they face a long sentence.
Yeah, but again, it's twofold, and it comes back to if I'm a police officer and I am going to put myself in harm's way, one, I'm going to then risk, right, if somebody resists, what I have to do to put them in handcuffs and maybe be falsely accused of use of force or whatever may happen, knowing that the DA is going to simply let the person out within 24 hours, maybe give them, you know, no penalty at all, give them diversion for you know, selling whatever, being in possession of 100 grams of fentanyl because it doesn't matter, then they're less incentivized to do their jobs, right?
Do you think they purposely undermine Boudin?
No. That's not my interpretation of what
was going on. Think the jobs are done? Because we've seen this also around Prop 47, right? A lot of pushback by law enforcement saying, if we don't think we don't like this policy and we're not going to enforce misdemeanors because it won't result in anything. Should that really be the job of the police?
I think all of us as players in this criminal justice system have a job to do, and we should do it regardless of what, whether or not we agree or disagree with certain laws. That was a part of my complaint about the previous administration is the selectivity of which laws they chose to enforce. And so, no, as law enforcement agencies, we need to simply just do the function of our job, which is to enforce the laws of the state of California.
What about police accountability? I mean, I think Chesa Boudin definitely prosecuted some police officers. One was acquitted. How are you going to – do you think he was too aggressive in that regard? Will you change, you know, your threshold for going after a police officer for one reason or another?
I think the threshold should always be the law. What the law says is our threshold. I don't think these cases should be political whatsoever. I think the charging should be based on whether or not there is misconduct under the law. And I am committed to continuing to prosecute any type of misconduct that is criminal.
Should police be held to a higher standard?
They should be held to the standard that the law holds them to. And so that's the framework of which I have to work within is what the law says. And so if one of them performs in a way that's in violation of that law, then I have the obligation to prosecute them accordingly, just like I do anybody else on the street. Nobody gets a pass based on, you know, what their status or position is in our society.
I'm curious, you know, we do not have a lot of room in our county jail. The sheriff's deputies are woefully understaffed. I've talked to folks who have concerns about the mental health treatment people are getting because of that understaffing. And a lot of what you're talking about would result in people being held longer or being put in jail maybe who wouldn't have before. How do you tackle that? Is there room, you know?
So I think, one, there are certain assumptions about whether or not more people will go to jail or not. But even if we take that assumption as true, it's my job to work with, you know, Sheriff Paul Miyamoto to make sure that he, you know, that we're working together and that he has what he needs to make this system continue to function. So that's, I think, you know, all the city agencies working together to make sure that we're all doing our jobs to the best of our ability to keep the public safe.
Obviously, you're going to look at different cases in different ways than your predecessor. But like, can you be specific? Like, for example, will you be seeking ganging enhancements where Boudin might not have? Will you be taking into account previous strikes in you know, an effort to get a longer sentence potentially?
You know, I haven't made all of my, you know, I haven't made certain policy changes yet. I've tried to make it clear that I agree in large part with the spirit of many of Chesa Boudin's policies, right? Mm-hmm. That we should not be overusing gang charges or enhancements, that it's something that has, you know, historically been used against people of color, and that we should be much more thoughtful about the occasions where that's appropriate. But what I don't want to do and what I've never believed in is the removal completely of prosecutorial discretion, right? There are going to be certain circumstances where something may be called for and we have to use the laws available to us to bring justice in that case. But I always want to be thoughtful about the equity that goes on in this system. And so as I craft the policies going forward in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office, I'm going to try to make sure that we keep that spirit of fairness and equity in the way that we go forward.
I want to ask you, you know, during the recall, a lot of cases were brought up, you know, that you and others criticized Chase Aboudin about. And one of them is actually one involving a murder of a family member of yours, I think a cousin of your husband's. And you criticize Boudin for not seeking gang enhancements. And there's questions now, this case is pending, about how you plan to handle it. Like, will you recuse yourself? Should it go to an outside agency and not be handled by the DA's office? Where are you landing on all of that?
Yeah, so first I want to make clear that in that case, I was not calling for gang enhancements. It was a gang charge, because those are two very distinct things. But in my view, when a conflict exists, we need to make sure that we are seeking out another government agency, law enforcement agency, to handle that case. Okay. And in my opinion, I am proceeding right now under the assumption that a conflict exists. I can't say that the law necessarily would find that, but I'm proceeding that way because I want to even shun the appearance.
Right.
That's
what I was going to say. On some of these, isn't as much about the appearance as.
Yes. And so I take that extremely seriously, and I'm making sure that my office is doing what it takes to be able to get another agency to handle that case.
One of the things your predecessor did was to create this innocence commission. I think one person was freed already for having been wrongly convicted. And you've said you'll keep it, but like, how are you thinking of maybe changing its composition or its mission, if at all?
You know, I haven't arrived at any particular decisions about its composition. I think the mission is very clear, that it's to help to exonerate wrongfully convicted people. And that is something that I think is extremely valuable work and needs to continue. We should always be, you know, we all know, right? We've seen episodes on TV, specials of people who have sat for decades in prison because certain evidence wasn't available or was ignored. And so that is a mission that I want to continue in partnership with those who are working on that commission to make sure that it continues.
Yeah. So you obviously have a long, impressive resume, but this is a very new job for you. I'm not sure you've ever managed this many people before. I'm wondering kind of how you're approaching what's ahead. Have you talked to, say, Vice President Kamala Harris about how to do this job? How are you thinking about the nuts and bolts of managing this many attorneys?
Yeah. So, one, I think it comes down to making sure that the senior management staff in the DA's office has the necessary experience, right? They have more experience than I do. And so I want to surround myself with senior management who knows how to do this job and knows how to do it well and ethically. The other thing is, yes, being willing to seek advice from others who have been doing this much longer than me. And so I've already begun reaching out to some of the other surrounding county DAs and
you don't have a direct line to Kamala?
I don't have a direct line to the vice president.
I heard the governor's having lunch with her this week.
Yeah, maybe you can
hit up Newsom.
Yeah, well, maybe somebody out there could put in a word for me. But yes, this is going to take me, you know, consulting with other area county DAs to see, you know, what kind of policies they have or what management style they have so that I can develop my own here.
We have like 10 seconds left. We talked about you running track, doing hurdles in college. Anything you've learned from that experience that's going to help you in this job?
That you may get weary, but you keep going.
Keep going.
And so that's
right.
What I'll be doing.
Brooke All right. Jenkins.
Thank you so much, Brooke
Thank
Jenkins.
Thank you.
New district attorney for San Francisco. That'll do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time, everybody.
I'm Jonquilin Hill, host of The Weeds, and I know that politics can feel like a joke, and not always in the ha-ha funny way. On The Weeds, we try to split the difference.
When you think run out of money, you think that we're going to get to a point where like one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all, got to board up.
Like that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check and that's all the checks we got and Social Security is no more.
Check out The Weeds every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Think the case for global decline has been oversold? Then you should check out the latest season of What Could Go Right. It's co-hosted by me, Emma Varvalukas, and Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel. What Could Go Right may not have all the answers, but it asks the key questions. Every week, we discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or sensationalism. We talk with guests like NPR anchor Steve Inskeep, democracy expert Yasha Munk, prolific writer and historian Rebecca Solnit, and green energy entrepreneur Jigar Shah. So go ahead, listen to What Could Go Right on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.